Hello and welcome to a new edition of the Parle, the Hindu's weekly podcast. I am Varghese K. George, your host for today. Last week, the government of India prohibited retired officials of security and intelligence organizations from publishing anything about their work or organization without prior clearance from the head of the organization. Serving civil servants are barred from expressing their personal opinion on policy matters and criticizing the government. But once retired, several of them take part in public debates and enrich our conversations. The restrictions now imposed by the government of India are sweeping, though limited to a specific category of officials. In this edition of Parle, we discuss whether there should be any restrictions on the freedom of expression of retired government officials, and if there must be, what should be the limits of such restrictions? How could policy making and public debates benefit from the expertise of retired civil servants? Our guests today have spent decades in civil service. They have held some of the topmost positions in Indian civil service. Both of them continue to actively engage with public policy even after retirement. It's my pleasure to introduce G.K. Pillai, former Home Secretary of India, and Syed Akbaruddin, who was India's permanent representative to the United Nations. Welcome you both, Mr. Pillai and Ambassador Akbaruddin. Do you think restrictions imposed on retired officials of intelligence and security organizations are justifiable? Mr. Pillai, I'll start with you.
See, we have what I call as the Official Secrets Act, and officers of the intelligence and security organizations who have been in government in their respective departments are privy to a lot of sensitive information. So the fact that government needs some control over that information leaking into the public is, I think, we all of us in the service, we take that into account. The issue is really now whether it is all information on which there is really not much clarity yet, or is it the sensitive information, and then who decides what is sensitive and what is not sensitive? So these are two critical issues which have come, because in the past, if you've seen a number of, I'll possibly mention that later on when it comes, some books, memoirs have been written by the head of R&DW and so on, where there could be an interpretation that some information which is of a sensitive nature has leaked out, which compromises, what shall I say, the interests on the ground. And that is something which, therefore, the government would like to have some control so that existing, say, intelligence security operations are not affected by such leakage of information, perhaps even given out inadvertently. That is really the issue against, of course, general information, which is, the right to information, and which is gives you that little bit of right. Of course, the security agencies are not included in that. But there is this fine balance which has to be struck. And we have so far been managing that. And many retired officers who are in these sensitive organizations actually informally get their drafts vetted by the current head of the security services, so that there is no information which is of operational nature could get compromised. And therefore, this is something that does take place. The government have now put it in writing in a formal manner, and we have to see how it goes.
Right. So you are in favor of some kind of restrictions, but the set of restrictions that have been announced, which are these restrictions will stay for life, and the word sensitive is left open to definition, which could be subjective. And also, if one person may have worked in say a few of those organizations, how those that could be managed. So if we manage to find answers for all these operational or implementation issues, you are in principle for some kind of government regulation on what is being said by at least officials who have retired from these organizations, right?
That is what, yes, in principle, and I would actually put it in one sense, a little bit of a time limit, if you want to put it, you know, 5 years from the time you've retired. I think most, by that time, most things, a lot of things would have changed, except for certain, as I mentioned, it is the operational information which is actually most sensitive, and that is something perhaps even inadvertently you may leave it, you may not think so, but other people in other intelligence agencies read the reports of, you know, our head of RNDW or IB, you know, with a fine tooth comb. And if they can find some information which is of use to them, that is something which is to be avoided.
Right. So at that point, I'll come to you, Ambassador Akbaruddin. So how do you see it? You've seen intelligence officials of countries like United States coming out with nearly tell-all tales about their operations. Of course, it goes through a vetting. But do you think, considering the fact that in India, there is no laid down rules on this, and those kind of sensational books are not really the very frequent in India, how would you see these restrictions, Ambassador?
Let me start by stepping one step back from the present day. The tradition of eyewitnesses or participants in various important historic events or important events, penning their thoughts, writing about their experiences, is a tradition which goes long back. It's not a 21st century phenomenon. If you go back and look at Indian history, some of the best source materials of Indian history are from those memoirs. So look at Megasthenes Indica. He was a envoy to the Mauryas. You can look at others, Al-Biruni, or you can look at Buddhist travelers, Fahian and Xuanzang. Now, all these have been inputs for our understanding of our history. Incidentally, if you look at some of these, most of them are by non-Indians. So the tradition of understanding history or important events through eyewitness accounts is not a new one. And that tradition, unfortunately, in the past, as far as India was concerned, was largely a tradition which was viewing these things from the prism of others other than Indians, because largely we were an oral tradition, not a written tradition. Largely, I'm not saying that there were exceptions. Now, if that is the point, over the years, there have been participants in our history who tell all tales. I mean, let us look at the father of our nation, Mahatma Gandhi. His writings, his books, his tell-all features of his life are there for all to see. And we have all gained from it. So the point that we can, of course, gain, and the public is better informed of activities, including those taken for the benefit of our own country's interests, are best when they are shared from different perspectives, and that should be the broad theme. Increasingly, following that thinking, large number of people in different levels have written. The former leader of the opposition, Sri Advaniji, has written an excellent book about his own experiences, etc. and all. So I think this is a tradition we should enlarge and increase in a generic sense. Let's take that as the background. Now, of course, we come to this issue of national security and the public's right to know. Some people view it as pulling in different directions, because they feel that there's always a tension between the government's desire to keep information secret on national security grounds and the public's right to information held by public authorities. Now, there is this tension which is always there, but I acknowledge that there is a near universal consensus among decision makers, not only in India, but elsewhere too, that some measure of secrecy is justified and necessary to protect authorized national security activities such as intelligence gathering, military operations, sometimes confidentiality of deliberations, sometimes personal privacy, and other reasons. So what is important is, in this broader picture, there needs to be a proportionality, that the solutions that are offered need to be in proportion to the problems that you have encountered. And that's where the Official Secret Act comes in. Even retired officials are bound not to reveal issues which come under the ambit of that, because that's where they got to know of it when they were serving. Whether this has been ridden roughshod by individual officers, if that is so, then action should be taken against those individual officers. So my general approach would be, we need to do anything that we want to do in proportion. I am not somebody who's engaged in the activities which are now sought to be fine-tuned, so I cannot get into the nitty-gritty of that. But I would say that in any issue, a balance, a proportionality needs to be done. But globally, there is no issue, whether you look at international covenants, Indian constitution, Indian law, there will always be provisions that justify some measure of secrecy on certain issues.
Right. So in a democracy, the public has a right to know. That is where the premise of why we have the right to information and a lot of accountability measures that are being built into our governance systems. Now, national security and intelligence services particularly, these have been kind of no-go area as far as information sharing is concerned. Already we have debates which are ongoing about how should these bodies be held accountable to democratic institutions, maybe parliamentary accountability. Those questions remain. So we are taking this measure at a time when we are not sure whether India's intelligence agencies or national security operations in general are accountable to public. So therefore, this is my question to you, Mr. Pillai. You've been the head of the Home Ministry, under which most of these operations at least fall under. So do you think there we are suffering from the problem that we have to address is too much of information being in public domain, or too less transparency in the functioning of our national security apparatus?
See, one of the important ways in which information is actually given to the public is by what we call as declassification of the files and the security, especially those files which we keep confidential and secret and top secret and so on. Most such files are what we say at the end of 30 years, we are supposed to do a very rigorous examination and then declassify most files. In America and all, under the Freedom of Information Act, after a particular period, except for those which are some sentences or words are redacted, most of it is available now to the public domain, in the public domain. Now, the real importance for in India is that we don't declassify information which is there, say, 30 years ago. Most files could be declassified. I'll just give you an example of the Henderson-Brooks report of 1962 war. Now it's more than what, 50 years plus? I really don't think there's anything in that report which we should really be worried about now if it comes in the public domain. Maybe, it has some bearings on, but it's totally irrelevant now that somebody may have, not looked at it properly and so on. There's been enough reports readings, writings, and so on. And copies of that is actually out in the internet itself. So why are we keeping it a secret? So, and therefore, because you're keeping it a secret, there's a lot of speculation about what is there and what is not there in the report. So I think that is that part. If the declassification of information took place, also it will give a lot of information out and people can write, you know, research articles as well as books on what is the declassified information that is available. I'll give another example. You know, the Justice Mukherjee report on the Subhash Chandra Bose death. Now, the Justice Mukherjee report was, you know, years ago. And yet we've kept on getting information and the RTI, you see, please give us extracts of this, extracts of that. And I took the view as Home Secretary saying that, look, the Justice Mukherjee report runs into lakhs of pages. And for us to be spending money trying to, in the Home Ministry, to make copies and give people who are asking for information, best thing is to say, I declassify it, send it to the National Archives, and all those who want it can collect it from there because it's now in the public domain in the National Archives. So it is sent there and people can, those who want to, can look at it or send the RTI application to the National Archives and get copies. The Home Ministry should not be bothered about it. I agree with what Ambassador has said, that by and large, the emphasis should be let as much come into the public domain. The officers should be sensitive enough, because especially if they are senior officers, they should be sensitive enough to make sure that operational or information that might affect current workings should not come into your book, because you've been in the sensitive security organization. And my general impression is, because from my experience, in almost all cases, they do get an informal vetting done by the current head of the department.
Do you think that was a reasonable system where the current
I think so. If you are an IB or a RNAW officer, and if you are writing some memoir or you are writing about some incident or some aspect, if you can show your draft to the current head of the IB or RNAW, and if he says, I have no problems with your publishing this, I think that should be enough.
Hmm. All right. So, Ambassador, again, slightly stepping back to a global scenario, in a democracy such as even the United States, there is a challenge that the security agencies put out a story which the public will have no way to verify independently, barring some investigative journalism, which again will be dependent on some other intelligence officials or government officials who are willing to share that information. So here we are going around in circles. There is no way what is being protected as information for the purpose of national security being brought to a public scrutiny. So that while both of you are broadly in agreement with the fact that the tendency should be towards more transparency, do you fear, do you notice that actually the direction that democracies in general are taking is in the opposite? They want to be in control of more and more information.
You know, reconciling these divergent interests of national security and the right of public to know is always an ongoing challenge. I mean, I don't think anybody has been able to get it exactly right. A stable security policy is always hard to achieve, since the boundaries of official secrecy cannot be clearly articulated in the abstract, and national security issues keep evolving and sometimes dramatically evolving. So you will always have a unsatisfactory situation in this. So we need to start with that premise. But that said, I will take again a step back and go to where Mr. Pillay mentioned about declassification. Now, declassification is an important tool in raising public awareness after a specified period. Now, in our case, there are two issues. One is sometimes we are less than forthright about declassification, as some examples that he has given. But in the beginning, we are also more conservative about classification itself. You know, if you overly classify something which perhaps need not have been classified, declassification of that becomes a much more difficult exercise, even if it's not required. There are n number of examples of situations. For example, 5 years ago, or less than that, we contested many elections in the UN, and one was a very tough election. And at that time, we sent some messages, cables, etc., and all, which at that time made sense. What was this? But today, it's down the line. Everybody knows what happened. The success was ours. Do we still need to classify it in a certain manner? So both declassification as well as classification is an important thing. And then I'll come to your issue of democracies. Now, we need to understand that, do we want an explosion of deep throats? That if you block all avenues of information or gradually reduce them, then you will have to resort to the deep throat kind of activities, which is not good for a evolving society or any society. So the US itself moved long beyond deep throat. But what has happened is, I think after 9/11, there has been a concern on national security. And that's where we can trace a lot of issues relating to national security being tightened up. So the phenomenon of tightening up of information, non-disclosure of information, can be traced back to, I would say, almost two decades. It's not a new phenomenon of new democracies, etc., but it goes back to the sudden existential fears that were done relating to the war against terrorism, that it being an existential threat, etc. Of course, as that has moved on, you haven't been able to roll back some of those. In fact, once you are in that space, it is difficult to roll back those, because that's the nature of the beast, that once there is a status quo, you find it difficult to pull back. So I would think that as it is based on you, if you feel a sense of crisis, if there is a pervasive concern that as a society you feel, all these barriers will come up. As it eases up in terms of a broader phenomenon, this will ease up, because this is a smaller part of a bigger whole of concern of national security, national interest, threats, mounting threats, etc. So until those are addressed, I would say that this individually will not be addressed so easily.
Right. I think both of you are also broadly in agreement with the fact that the restrictions that you are favoring is based on the calculations of operational questions. As long as sharing of information with the public is not causing a harm to the country's operational capabilities, both of you seem to be okay with the sharing of information. Am I right, Mr. Pillai? I'll come to you first.
Yeah, I think so too. I think, you know, and I think it's a timely context. You know, just this very simple example, just two sentences. You know, during the 1971 war, I mean, every time Pakistan said that, you know, India is interfering in Bangladesh, etc., we denied it throughout 1971 till the war was over.
Right.
Subsequently, after that, any number of books have been written by, from, you know, top army commanders to BSF to other people who have said how they operated inside Bangladesh, starting from whatever March or even earlier to that. So I don't think it really doesn't make any difference to us that whether at that time, yes, there's a political imperative in diplomacy, etc., to say we are not interfering in the internal affairs of another country. Today, I think it doesn't make any difference if somebody writes about it. And I think people have written, and I don't think the Official Secrets Act or anything has been invoked against anybody who has written about that.
Though technically, it may have been possible to invoke some of these acts against them, right?
Yeah, because it was our official policy at that time, and we denied it in all forums that we never interfered in inside Bangladesh, inside East Pakistan.
You think that overclassification is a problem, and we could afford to be much more liberal than we currently are in terms of declassifying information. Am I right?
Oh, yes. Declassification, I think, is an area which everybody plays safe way, but I think at least, and as a general hint, I think at least 50% of the top secret and secret files in Government of India can be declassified straight away. I mean, I would put it as an off-the-cuff remark based on what I know. Easily 50% can be done, and some of it has been done. I remember thousands of files being declassified when I was in the Home Ministry, but we've still got thousands more which could be done, and this is not something which is a priority work for the department. And that is why I'm also in favor of a time limit like, you know, the United States has. You know, you put 30 years or 40 years or whatever you want to put it, at the end of 40 years,
everything is automatically
declassified whether somebody does it or not.
Right.
So you have to do, if you want to keep it, then you have to actively say, this file is not being, but otherwise it automatically gets declassified.
Right. So Ambassador Akbaruddin, again, I would seek a comparison from you again. So do you think compared to other democracies, India is relatively more stricter when it comes to sharing of official secrets, quote unquote?
So if you look at the tradition of this transparency efforts, the first such effort actually goes back to Europe. I think it's Sweden or something in 1776, because then the parliament wanted access to the executive authority. However, it is only in the latter, or in fact, towards the end of the 20th century and the beginning half of the 21st century, that this proliferation of what we call the right to information in the Indian context has proliferated globally. They were also after the East Europeans in moved out of the Soviet bloc. They came up with this, others came up, and India was also one of those. So there are, I think, about between 95 to 100 countries today who have these disclosure arrangements in place. They still haven't covered the entire expanse, because there are, of course, caveats to this. But if you sit back and see in historical context, availability of information is certainly much more now than it was, say, 25 years ago or 30 years ago. Whether it is adequate, my answer would, like Mr. Pillai, be no. Whether it should be expanded, my answer would be yes. Whether it should be absolute, my answer again would be no, because no right to freedom of expression can be absolute. It will always be restricted in the certain context, and it will be best for all of us if these are clarified from time to time, because these circumstances keep evolving, and clarification and enunciation of this is a part of the growth of transparency. Whether in India or elsewhere, and certainly we need that consistent and regular approach to expanding that scope.
Right. So we have a few minutes left, and I have the same question to both of you, who are custodians of quite a bit of official and national secrets which you have accumulated through your careers. So now, what would be the blurb of your memoirs as an Indian diplomat ambassador? Have you thought about it? How much will you be willing to reveal? What will be your consideration when it comes to how much to tell, to balance the public interest and the existing regulations and your own intellectual honesty? How will you frame that thing, your book? I am assuming that you will have a book soon.
Well, you're not assuming wrong. I'm working on something.
Yeah.
As a citizen of a free and democratic country, which is based on free flow of information, and the right to of the public to awareness of situations start from that premise that as much as is feasible to reveal without, of course, revealing national secrets or difficult situations where policy, you see, in policy debates, it can happen. You may have differences of opinion. And the differences of opinion can be reflected without indicating where individuals are involved, etc. So I would come from the proposition that greater transparency, greater public awareness, and the tradition of eyewitnesses providing factual perspectives of their own should be my pathway forward. It's not a new pathway, as I said, I traced it back to thousands of years. So in that pathway, if we can be small footnotes, I would be happy to be that small footnote in sharing at a broader level what are issues that were of interest and remain of perennial interest for the broader public.
Correct. That is very well put. So let me come to you, Mr. Pillai. So I shall recall this comment of former Prime Minister P.V. Narasimha Rao, who was asked about India-US conversations, I think, in the run-up or immediately after the nuclear explosion or some related stuff in the 80s. So he said, those secrets will perish with me. Mr. Pillai, how much of what you know, do you think will you be able to share in a book format or in a public lecture at some point in your time? 50% of all that you know could be shared? Or how would you...
I think about 80% can be shared, some 20% can't be shared, partly because the people involved are still there, are contemporaries, living contemporaries. And you don't want, especially if they are in the political sphere, you don't want either their opponents or the other way around, both sides to be able to take advantage of what you have written to. So that those are some of the reservations that we have when we are thinking of, in fact, putting pen to paper. But insofar as general administration, governance issues, policy, I don't think there's not much of a problem in trying to put some of the things down. I think many IAS officers have done it. I haven't done it. I still have some reservations, partly because of more of controversies than otherwise. So I been a little bit more circumspect in that.
You've been heading the Home Ministry as a secretary at a very crucial time. There were a lot of things that public would like to know more about. So are you at some point think in terms of writing a book? Are you working on one already? Or?
I think of it, but not at the moment. I'm not working at it, maybe a little later.
All right. Okay. So on that note, we will conclude. Thank you so much, Mr. G.K. Pillai and Ambassador Akbaruddin. I look forward to reading Ambassador Akbaruddin's book soon. And definitely, we look forward to reading Mr. Pillai also. And we would urge him to write. Thank you so much, both of you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.